So to me, the wrong way to teach is teaching the abstraction and removing the reality, because it does most of us a disservice. I mean, there's some people, very few people, who can think abstractly, but the rest of us think concretely, and we are used to living in the world and solving world problems. Yeah, large language models have really blown my mind. I thought after seeing a lot of things in AI that I was immune to getting my mind blown away. But like, I think it's not just gonna be AI, it's gonna be human with AI.
Exactly. So, Luis,
All
after
right.
3 years, I think you were on episode number two, finally back to my podcast. Luis Serrano, welcome to my show.
Thank you very much, Joseph. I'm very happy to be here again.
Nice. So, for people who don't know you, Luis, can you quickly explain who are you and why should people actually know you? Like, you wrote a book, you have a bunch of courses that you released online. Like, tell the audience who you are.
Thank you. Yes, I'm a bit all over the place. My path is always a zigzag. So right now I work on large language models, but previously I worked in quantum machine learning and in other things. But the main denominator of all my work is the education part. So I always, whatever it is that I'm doing, I try to be explaining it in all different ways. So I have this book that I have right here, Grokking Machine Learning, where I like to explain things in a very simple way because that's the way I understand them. Formulas and code confuse me, and so I try to really look at the simplest possible example that like a 5-year-old would understand. And so aside from the book, I have a YouTube channel. It's called Serrano.academy, and there I put all my videos. That's really the where I have fun and just put all the stuff I'm thinking about. And then lately I've been getting a bunch of courses out. So I just got one course out on large language models. The link is easy, llm.university. So LLM for large language models dot university. And I did that with my current job, which is at Cohere. So over there, we with some really good content developers, Jay Alamar. You've probably seen him. He has a lot of content, and Mior Amer, who's got some books and great content too. So we put a bunch of content on large language models, basically how to use them, how they work, attention models, embeddings, all that stuff. Again, in a very simple way that everybody can understand them, and a bunch of labs on, like, again, embedding, semantic search, classifying, generation, obviously prompt engineering, which is very important, deployment, things like that. So it's basically a 0 to 100 on large language models. And then I have another course coming up pretty soon. Actually, two of them came out. It's a 3-course specialization that I'm building with Coursera, with Andrew Ng and team. And it's on math for machine learning. So one course is linear algebra, the other course is calculus, and the third course, which is about to come out, is probability and statistics. And we focus that on things that are useful for machine learning. So the math you need to know to really take you one step further in machine learning to understand things like gradient descent, like dimensionality reduction, like the kind of A/B testing, all those kind of things that just kind of put you one level further if you were a data scientist. So yeah, I mean, a bit all over the place, but I always really enjoy explaining stuff.
Sounds really, really exciting. So let's maybe split it into two paths. So one being large language models, so LLMs, and then the other one being the specialization that you've worked on with Andrew.
Of
Before
course.
we jump into that, we talked about the podcast, like kind of that you're also a little bit overwhelmed at the moment. So how does it feel as a, let's say, content creator to be all over the place and like create content on a continuous basis? You also need your breaks, right? So how do you manage kind of work-life balance, what people call it? How do you do that?
Yeah, I try to manage it. Sometimes I succeed, sometimes I don't. The last few months, a lot of things have sort of converged. So I have a few big launches on the last few months. So it's been a little busy, but I do. I mean, creating content is a bit of a hobby for me. So if I'm the weekend and I'm just drawing little squares and things like that, to me it's a bit of an art. So I enjoy that. But I try to get out. I'm from Colombia originally, but I live in Canada. We've been trying to escape the winters, and I go there for for a couple of months a year, and so that's been fun because there I can disconnect a little bit. But yeah, it's also a challenge.
It's nice. Also on your YouTube channel, I'm not sure when you still upload videos on a continuous basis, right, on your YouTube channel?
Yeah, I do. Although that one's the one that suffers if I'm launching other stuff. So when I have these two big courses that are launching, I haven't been able to put stuff on the YouTube channel. But I do have a bit of a backlog, and I do have some material I want to put there. And in the recent things, you know, large language models, I want to put some stuff on transformers, on image generation, things like that. So upcoming stuff should happen soon.
What is the big vision for you? Why education? Why is it so exciting for you?
I think that, I don't know. I feel like when two things align, then you're fulfilled, right? Like I think I like to do it when it's the stuff you like for yourself, like just for fun. Like I would do it even if nobody watches it. I really enjoy understanding my stuff. And the other one is what you believe for the world, what you want to give to the world. And I think those two align, right? Because I think I think it's a great thing to give education to the world for free. I think it's an opportunity that I think only our generation has been able to properly have and a little more every time. It wasn't so easy in the past. Things education was gated, and only the privileged could get it. Now it almost feels like much more people can get it through the internet. So I try to contribute to that movement as much as I can, and to get people to give people an opportunity, and that's for them and also for the rest of us, right? Like I think some many brilliant people don't have access to education, and I want them to have it for them and also for what they can do for the world, right? And so those things align because I also just enjoy it myself. Like I understand things the way you see it on the videos and what I write and stuff is the way I understand stuff. And I always have to explain everything to myself like that. Like if I'm in a class and somebody puts a complicated formula and I am completely lost, then I have to go home and explain it with the little dogs and cats and things like that. And that's how I understand it. So it's fun for me. So I'm basically one step away from sharing it to the world, right? Like that takes me the longest is what I do for myself. And so then I just put it on a video or on a blog post and share it to the world. And it's people have received it so well that I'm very thankful for, you know, the messages I get and the numbers that I see it. And it really warms my heart. So it's something I really enjoy.
Yeah, really cool. How do you see it, the differentiation between paid courses or universities versus free education? Like, where do you draw the line? Should education be always free? Or where do you when do you start charging for education?
I think education should be 100% free. I think you should get paid for learning, because it's not just free. Like you also need to not be working at that time. Like, you know what I mean? Like even if you make university free, many people don't have the opportunity because they just don't have the means to actually live while they're studying. So I think we should be paid to learn, because you're going to pay for it the rest of your life by the contributions you do to the world. So I think it should be completely free. The online education is, I think the model is getting figured out. I haven't really seen any player who has really figured it out, but there's a lot of good attempts. You know, I'm the one who makes the courses. I keep saying when I make courses with people, I'm like, I'm the one who does the fun and you're the one who has to figure out how to keep us, you know, eating. So I think, you know, as a model, I think anything that always has a free option has to be the case. Like sometimes they charge for a certificate or for maybe more feedback, maybe for human feedback. Like I think if that's what it needs to stay, or ads or something, YouTube or things like that. Like I think whatever model that needs to be done. And again, I'm lucky I'm not the one figuring that out. I'm just the one doing the stuff in the circus, the one teaching. I think there should always be a option that is 100% free. I think we should not be putting gates on education, because we're we're doing ourselves a disservice by not giving someone an opportunity to give all they can give to the world.
Mm. I think I recently encountered that when I tried, I actually bought an MIT course, and at the end it was like almost 2,000 euros. Wow. To some extent, you kind of pay into, of course, with money, you can pay into higher education or like more specialization. But then I wonder if it's really worth the 2,000 euros, because at the end of the day, you could also get a Udacity course from Lewis, explaining it maybe in a bit different way, which is not 2,000 euros. So that's a bit difficult, to be honest. Like,
yeah,
it's a branding thing, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, sometimes the quality is there, but I it's been a while since I don't pay for a course, and you never know, right? Because they may not be that good, or maybe good, but you know, you don't know. Maybe taught by a very famous person who can't explain anything, and then you're just watching a famous person do their stuff, and that's it. I think everything can be found for free. Sometimes people, you know, sometimes they pay for the certification or for the stamp of approval and stuff. And I think I'm hoping that we don't depend on that anymore. I mean, I think previous generations, you depended a lot on what diploma you had, which is could be an assessment of people's work and people's talents, but it's also an assessment of, you know, how much privilege they had and could get into a university that their parents paid, or also how much, you know, if you did something amazing at 15 and got into a great university, that does, you know, it's like a certificate of something that happened in the past and not in the present. So I believe a lot in changing the sort of the diploma certification by a portfolio. And that's something we did in Udacity. Oh, but I forgot to mention that. Yeah. You mentioned I have a bunch of courses in Udacity as well.
Yeah.
That's something that I was trying to do there, which is, sure, you get a certification, but all the projects were aimed to get you something in GitHub. Mm-hmm. And then when you look at data scientists, for example, I kind of want them to walk around with the GitHub portfolio in their hand and be like, this is my GitHub, check out all the projects I've done. Just like an artist, right? Like, you don't go around saying, buy my painting because I went to Harvard. You say, this is my portfolio. If you like it, you buy my paintings. If not, you don't. So I want that to be the new diploma, right?
I think that makes sense. Yeah, completely. When we now talk maybe about certifications, how does the Coursera course work that you've worked on with Andrew? Is it like you can get it with Coursera Plus, or do you have to pay for it separately? How much does it cost? How long does it
take? Yes, there is a cost. It's not very big. I don't know exactly the numbers, so I'll if I say them and they're wrong, then. But this is not very expensive to pay for the course, but you're paying for the certification. And mm-hmm. for, I think, the access to like grading of the quizzes and stuff like that. But the material can always be for free. So you can actually go and audit and see all the material for free, which is what I've done. I normally audit the courses online that I take. So I like that there's the two options. And you can enroll for the whole certification, for the whole specialization, which is the three courses. Or you can enroll for each course separately.
Got it. Okay.
Yeah.
How did Coursera reach out to you, and how was it recording the course with Andrew? Because he's like the rock star, kind of in machine learning.
Oh, he's a rock star.
Space. How was it for you?
I was starstruck. Since I'm in the education space, and you know, at Udacity, I had connections. They were looking for someone to teach math for machine learning, but they wanted it sort of in that style. So people that I had already worked with at Udacity reached out and said, hey, do you want to build this course? And I thought it was a great idea. So I'm like, of course, I definitely want to build it. And with Andrew, we thought about the curriculum for a while. We tried a few different things. We started with a course that was basically just machine learning with math. So I was going through the whole machine learning curriculum and adding the extra math. And then he said, no, I don't know if that works, because like we already have the sort of machine learning one, and then this is the same thing but with extra math, so people don't know where to go in. And so we decided to just make it math. Like, how would you teach a math course? And we're debating if making four courses, with probability being one course, statistics another one, calculus and linear algebra, or making probability statistics together. We ended up making it together, the two courses together. But we really thought about the curriculum because first we wanted to make them 1 month courses, and first we had just way too many topics. Right, you just go crazy, and then we started saying, okay, what do they need for machine learning? And if they don't need it for machine learning, or at least whether it's a direct form to give them some kind of intuition, then we remove that. So we left everything that's in the course has a pretty direct machine learning application, and we mention it all the time. Like, we're like, okay, this will help you with BCA, this will help you with neural networks. But yeah, I mean, his vision is great too. I like to see his vision. I think he really cares about educating the world, and so in that we completely aligned. And recently went to film with him, so it was really nice to. I was saying that I told him this that 10 years ago, pretty much to the date, is when I took the first machine learning course. I didn't know anything about it. I didn't know what machine learning was, and I started taking a course. His course, and then I really liked it. And I was like, oh, okay, this is actually pretty fun stuff and pretty simple. And so I became a machine learning engineer. I just switched my jobs because of that course. And then 10 years exactly later, I was on the other side of the camera with the same guy who was teaching the course. So it was cool. It was very, very surreal. And I had a team of really good people. I had the course, the person who was leading the course was just wonderful. And we got along really well and started really clicking the material. His name was Fan Schumann, and we really went with sort of one. It helped me go one more level in my teaching. And and some people were helping with the slides. I had two people. One was helping me a lot with the math, and another one making slides. And they really picked up my style. Like we really got we were a well-oiled machine. So it was actually I found that I can make good content by myself, but I actually found that with this team I could make better content. So it was really cool.
Yeah, I think it also feeds back to the content production value that you give on YouTube, right? I mean, when you first started YouTube, probably your first video was complete, like showing slides and clicking through slides, and then you learn how to do animations. Yeah. I think the colleague of yours, Jay, is his name, right?
Oh, Jay. Yeah, Jay's amazing.
He does it very well on his YouTube channel, like how to do animations in Keynote, etc. That's pretty cool.
Yes, yes, yes. He pushes the envelope there. And, I work with him now, right? Like, he's actually, he hired me at my current job. And he does great animations in Keynote. And him and I worked at Udacity together. I enjoy his videos a lot. And I'm always asking him about machine learning and all these models. And I get explanations from him. I've been enjoying sort of getting. I still use Keynote, but I've really learned to make animations there. I think I'm due to find something more to make more math animations, but Keynote has worked pretty well so far. So
I think an overkill would be over engineering. It would be Manim if you use Manim, but then
you need to.
But then you need to use a lot of. Yeah, not a lot of code, but you need to invest more time into it. So the production value goes up, but in parallel, you need to invest more time as well. So maybe a video might take 3 weeks or 4 weeks to actually go live.
Yes, I've been wanting to learn Manning. It's the stuff you can make there is surreal. So definitely I've been wanting to learn that. But I feel like I have to put a fixed amount of time of just learning and no production. And I'm always producing stuff. So I need to at some point take a break and learn that one. That may be that's actually one I was thinking that I learned next.
Yeah. When you were coming up with your curriculum, because I also teach courses online more in the engineering space, but do you think there is a right way to teach stuff and also a wrong way to teach stuff? Because there's a ton of math courses out there, even machine learning and large language models. What do you believe is the wrong way to teach a course? And what do you believe is the right way to teach a course?
Ooh, yes. Unfortunately, the wrong way to teach the course is the most common one. I feel like I make this analogy, right? Imagine if you go to a concert and let's just say classical music. And instead of playing the music, there's no orchestra. There's just some person in the front with a board, and they start drawing the notes, and they go, oh, look, this is wonderful. And everyone's like, oh my God, nobody's going to go to that concert, right? Because it focuses on the technicality and not on the music behind. And so in music, that'd be awful. But for some reason, in the rest of the things, it's the norm. Like in mathematics, that's the norm. Somebody's on the front and it's just drawing formulas. And in STEM, it's like that. In engineering, in machine learning, in physics, everything is just taught in the most complicated way. With I don't believe in, I mean, formulas should appear, but later, you know? But I try to not have a single formula. Because a single formula is like if they stop the concert and we're like, well, the next part of the song, we're just going to give you the partitura. No, no, not a single one. There shouldn't be one formula. If anything, sums, like of numbers. And I don't like variables. Numbers. Like if I'm going to say X plus Y, I say 2 plus 3, period. So to me, the wrong way to teach is teaching the abstraction and removing the reality. Because it does most of us a disservice. I mean, there's some people, very few people, who can think abstractly, but the rest of us think concretely, and we are used to living in the world and solving world problems, and we're very good at it, and we put a lot of math in it and a lot of physics into it. If not, we would just be falling in the floor all the time. Like, we know a lot of stuff. But when they remove that reality and start teaching it with abstraction, everybody gets lost. And that's why everybody says, oh, I'm terrible at math. It's like, no, you're not. You're terrible at abstraction. You're awesome at math because you couldn't survive the world without being awesome at math. You know, so that's the wrong way to teach. And I think there's many right ways to teach because I think we're all different, you know, and I think that we all learn in completely different ways. What education has done wrong is to just celebrate one way of learning and call all the other ones pretty much disabilities, right? Like anybody who learns in a different way is considered stupid. And I had that. I'm very distracted. I have ADD like crazy. And I thought I was stupid my entire life because I would just not understand anything in school. And it just turns out that I think a little different. Like I'm not that exact type of student that is designed to do well in classes and exams. And I think, as I said, we all think in different ways and we all learn in different ways. And if we all teach in that way, then we contribute something to that prism, you know, because we really, to understand, to see a three-dimensional object, you have to look at it from different angles to really understand it, not from one. So to understand things, you can't really just teach them in one way. You have to teach them in all the possible ones. And I have one way of teaching, and others have other ways. For example, one thing that we really thought a lot about this back when I was at Udacity with other educators, and we realized that there's at least three main ways that people learn. One is the visual one, the way I learn with little examples and colors and shapes and stuff like that. Another one is the building way. Like some people just say, for me to understand image recognition, I have to build something that recognizes images of cats. Like when I build it, I understand it. So I'm not that. But some people do work like that. Many engineers, I think, work like that. And the other one, I guess, is the abstraction way. Like some people do want to work out the entire formula or the entire theory. I'm kind of focusing on STEM, but this applies to most other fields, I think. But there's those three ways, and there's many more. And I think if we all teach the way we learn, then we can all contribute to the higher understanding. And that's why I teach the way I learn, because that's, you know, the easiest
thing. That makes sense. I was wondering, obviously, there's also a ton of people out there who maybe don't like your teachings or my teachings, for example.
Sure.
But I think that's completely fine. Do you think it's a problem that starts in school? Because in school, we only focus usually on the things, like when I'm a teacher, I focus on the things that are wrong, but we never teach kids what's actually right. We always have the red pen and you just make circles and this is wrong and this is wrong.
Absolutely. This is always
how kids become discouraged, actually, mm-hmm. in the very early ages.
Yeah, we get domesticated into a way of thinking that is negative, right? That is like, don't do this, this is bad. Yeah. And we should definitely be thinking of like what's good. We should not be trained with an error function. We're not neural networks, right? We should be, and also on the, not just that, but also on the sort of, there's one road, there's one way to understand it, there's one way to think this. And if you so much as deviate a little bit from it, then you're made feel guilty. At least that's how my upbringing was. Like, you just, you know, anything that if you think slightly different, you're crazy. So you just learn to not think like that. Yeah. And then as an adult, you just lost that ability, and that's not good. You know, we need to all have our own ideas and offer what we can to the world, right?
Okay. That would probably bring us to political discussions as well, but this is not what the podcast is about.
Ooh,
okay. So we'll quickly switch over to another topic, which is large language models. So maybe starting with the basics, so what are large language models in the first place, and how do they function from the first principles?
Yeah, large language models have really blown my mind. I thought after seeing a lot of things in AI that I was immune to getting my mind blown away. But when I started seeing them talk and create images and stuff like that, I was like, whoa, this is a new level. Large language models are, there's not a lot to them. Like, there's not a lot new to them. It's not like when neural networks came out, there was a completely new thing. No, this is just like an enhancement of what we already had, right? So a transformer is pretty much a humongous neural network trained on a humongous amount of data with some padding. And the padding really, really does a lot of stuff. So, for example, embeddings are really much better right now. And an embedding is simply where we talk to the computers. It's where the rubber meets the road, right? And embedding is when you turn words into numbers, because we can handle words and computers can handle numbers, but if there's no bridge, then whatever we do and whatever they do is going to be completely disconnected. It's like they're speaking a different language. So embeddings are the translation between numbers and between humans and computers. And the better they are, the better everything is. You know, like if tomorrow an embedding comes out that's 10 times better than everything, then all the models, language models, are going to be 10 times better. And so embeddings got much better. And another step is attention. Attention is really what has pushed the envelope. And attention is a step that allows the model to actually carry context. So before, it was just kind of like one word at a time. What's the most, you know, based on or with a recency bias of like what's the next word? I don't know if you've try to send a text by pressing the next recommended word in the phone, and you end up with things that if you take four or five words at a time, they make sense, but the whole paragraph is completely bogus. Transformers have pushed in that direction. So they actually carry the entire context. And I think that's the step that has really made large language models go one step further.
What do you think is maybe, of course, we talked about a little bit about applications. So do you maybe you can talk through applications that we don't know about, but also the limitations of these large language models, and also some other features to them, like that we don't know about. For example, we might talk about prompt engineering. This is also a course that Andrew offers with Coursera, I believe, or deep learning AI.
Yep.
So what are the applications at the moment that we don't hear about, and what are maybe the limitations?
Okay. Yeah. I mean, there's many applications of large language models. I think we're having a lot of fun with generation right now, because it's just fun to type something and get the computer to write a poem for you or whatever. Like that's really, really good. And definitely prompt engineering is becoming a huge thing. I think we get in higher and higher levels of like coding becomes a higher and higher level every time, you know, like a previous generations that wrote an assembly. I don't even know how assembly looks like. I read like Python, but maybe, you know, our grandkids are going to look at Python and it's going to look like assembly to them because they write code in words. So I feel like prompt engineering, could be the next coding. I could be wrong. Some people say that it's sort of it's like fine tuning. It's not going to be the thing. I may be wrong or right, but I do feel like it may become the next coding and creating the right prompts and the right chains of prompts is going to be a very, very important skill, which I kind of like because it sort of can bring more people into the equation, right? Not just the ones that have a coding mind, but people who may know more about other problems we can solve than are now able to solve them. So I'm very excited about prompt engineering, and yeah, Andrew has a course on that with OpenAI, and we have that in the course. We have that in LLM University, and we're planning to add more to that. So yeah, I'm learning about that, and it's very interesting.
One thing is, do you believe that prompt engineering will be a separate kind of category of jobs in the future? So there will be this high paid job, like 300-400K a year.
I don't know. I mean, I couldn't have predicted that we were going to have this language model so good right now. So I don't know my prediction abilities, but maybe, yes, I think that good prompt engineering is going to be very, very sought after in the future. And I think we're going to sort of move to that higher level of coding. And I feel like it's going to be very well sought, those jobs. To go back to the question where you asked me about other applications, I feel like, yeah, we're having a lot of fun with generation, but there's a lot of other really cool stuff that comes from large language models that is very useful, and not as flashy. But for example, like classification, right? Like we know classification from like 10, 15 years ago. That's what was cool 10 years ago, right? Like when you were just showing an image of a cat and it says cat and we're like, oh my God, the computer's house, you know? And now it's like a kid can write that. But like, for example, language classification, like, you know, when I started doing machine learning 10 years ago, we had to put thousands and thousands and thousands of examples to get it to learn what a happy sentence or a sad sentence is. Now you need like four. Because if you have good embeddings, they can do it pretty quickly. And you can get some pretty advanced like sentiment classifiers or just text classifiers with very few shots. So to me, that's actually fascinating. Obviously, it's not as flashy, but it's very fascinating. Mm-hmm. Good embeddings. I mean, like a good embedding can really do a lot for you, because it just means that you basically have a computer that speaks the languages and you can just teach it easy stuff like a human, right? You don't have to train it forever. And things like semantic search are very useful. If you have a really good embedding, and if it's an embedding with different languages, for example, multilingual, then you can search really well. And that helps with generation, right? Because I want the computer to talk nicely, but I want to say the truth too, and perhaps even have like citations or something. So semantic search is something that I'm very, very interested in right now. Actually, one of the next things coming out in the LLM university course is semantic search. A lot of really cool things with re-ranking and retrieval, augmented generation, things like that are very fascinating. So yeah, there's a lot of other applications that come out of there. And you also asked me about limitations. I mean, we can go in two directions. I mean, I feel like technical limitations are less and less every time. I feel like when I think of a limitation, by the time I stop thinking about it, by the time I understand it, somebody has solved it. So they get better and better every time. I think we need to start. I don't know, like, I think we have some siloed directions, like language and image and, you know, things that move. I think it'd be good to sort of start combining them. That may be a challenge. But I think the biggest limitation that language models have, and this may go into a philosophical rabbit hole, so, but I think the people ask me a lot of, like, you know, are we done? Like, are the jobs finished? Like, are we useless now? And I think that ties with the limitations, right? Because we say, well, if I find a good limitation that like large language models and AI has, then that may be my next job, because that may still make me relevant as a human. And I think the limitations that they have and the hope that we have to stay relevant is anything that's one level higher of humanity, like empathy, you know, like emotional intelligence. All those things are huge limitations for the computer, and we can't expect them to have them, and we can't let a model run on its own because it doesn't have those capacities. Models only, whatever they do, they can be as advanced as you want. They always maximizing or minimizing one number, whatever that is, or a few numbers. The accuracy, the recall, the something, the similarity with this, you know, they're always maximizing something. And I think we humans have that thing that we sometimes not like that, but sometimes take decisions that that do not involve maximizing or minimizing any number. And I think that's the main limitation of computers and the main hope we have and the focus we should have to stay relevant.
Yeah, we'll see how the future evolves. I don't know. I kind of maybe want to think that it's possible to embed empathy into computers at some point, but maybe that could backfire pretty quickly. So
I think they can simulate it, because all they do is simulate, right? Like if you have a spam detector, they don't really know what a spam email is. They just do a calculation. And if it's a big number, you think it's spam, and but they don't know what spam is. And I feel like they may be able to simulate empathy. And I think they probably do already, emotions and stuff. But they just kind of put the words together that convey an emotion. But I don't know if they're able to make decisions based on that. I don't know. We'll see.
Yeah, we'll see. What do you think, especially in engineering, it's commonly known, or like we say that not an engineer, like not AI will substitute the engineer, but an engineer using AI will substitute the engineer who's not using AI. It's probably going to be in every field, whether that's marketing, finance, whatever. So I think you should actually start to learn AI as fast as you can. Take some Coursera courses, prompt engineering, etc. To actually not only become more efficient, but also compete against other applicants for a specific job, for example. Would you say the same thing?
Oh, absolutely. It's like learning how to use a computer, right? Like 20, 30 years ago, it was an option. Only some jobs would do it, but now it's not even a question. They're like, should I learn how to use a computer? Obviously. Like they learned before the kids like learn how to use a computer before they, you know, anything else. And so, I think it's like that. I think it's not just going to be AI. It's going to be human with AI, just like it was with, I don't know, tractors and farm equipment, right? They didn't just take over. It's a human operating it. Now we don't need 10 humans doing it, but one with a machine. And I think the same thing is going to be now. Like we don't need a lot of humans. We just need one with the power of AI. As you see, like this stuff is democratizing more and more every time. Like prompt engineering is much more accessible to people than coding was, right? It takes a lot more common sense and a lot less of a programming mind. And so I think more people can access it. I think everybody's gonna know these things in the future.
Yeah. We'll have to see when we talk about things like self-driving cars. Obviously, someone might be substituted, but I think also new doors open up in the future. So maybe new jobs emerge, for example. So,
Yeah, I think new jobs will emerge. I think we're always going to be working. People say they're going to lose our jobs. And I'm like, no, somebody, you know, like I wish. But we're always going to be employed and producing that. We can't escape that. So I think new jobs will appear.
I think that philosophical question leads us to a more ethical question. Is there like ethical considerations, maybe if we talk about bias and maybe fairness of the model? Is that embedded in these large language models?
I mean, not in the model, but in the data.
Overcome bias. Is that possible?
Yeah, that's a huge problem. That's a huge problem. And it needs to be addressed constantly. Because the data that we're giving to these models is data of humans. So it's racist, it's sexist, it's all the bad ists. And if you train a model with that, then obviously the model is going to respond with that. And so there's the first level of fixing, which is, you know, do the obvious fixes, you know, clean it up like this. But there's a lot of correlations. And the correlations are very hidden. For example, if you have something that checks resumes and gives jobs to people, and it happens to be racist or sexist, and you manage to remove the race of the gender, it's still going to pick up other things and make decisions on those, and it's still going to mimic like previous bad behavior from humans. So I think you have to constantly be monitoring two things, the data and the models. And it may be hard to completely escape it, you know, because humans are still like that, but I think maybe you need to three things, like the data, the models, and actually educate the humans to stop those behaviors. But it's a challenge.
Yeah. I was thinking like probably not training it on Twitter data or tweets.
Do not train your Twitter. Do not even get close to a YouTube comment section. Do not even touch the temple. When I worked at YouTube, nobody ever even looked at that data. It's horrible data. Yeah, and Twitter comments are also. I don't know if you've seen. There was some chatbot trained on. I don't know if it was Twitter or.
I think it was Reddit.
Yes.
It was trained on Reddit comments, and then he just tried to kill people also.
It was the most awful. Yeah.
That was crazy. This is super interesting. I think we should have a different session or maybe podcast when we talk about quantum machine learning. That's also super interesting. That's actually what was the first idea when we got in touch via email.
Yeah.
But maybe also talk a little bit more in depth into LLMs maybe in a year. Let's see how they...
In a year, we're going to say completely different. Remember when we talked 2 years ago? And I think it'd be funny if we look at that podcast because we're probably talking about neural networks and stuff. And now it's like completely different. I wonder if we talk 3 years from now and it's just going to be completely stuff that we don't even imagine right now.
Yeah, probably. And then maybe empathy is already embedded and we're like, we were so stupid 3 years back.
Yeah, I eat my words. I thought,
super cool. Maybe as a closing remark from your side, Luis, how can people sign up to the LLM university and what do they expect and what are the costs involved? I'm not sure if you're talking about
that. Thank you. Yeah, absolutely. LLM university is completely free. It's getting enhanced. We're adding a lot of material, but we have the course that is right now. It's a complete course on LLMs. And right now it's just the material is there. So if you go to this link, llm.university, you get into the first page and it's self-paced. It has quizzes, but right now they're not yet graded. They're just there. And it has a bunch of labs that you can run at your own pace, like code labs that you can run with Google Colab. So it's very much self-paced right now. But we made it, sequential and it's got everything. So I recommend people to just go to llm.university and just start going through the material. It's got very good reception. So we've been very, very happy. And because of that, we're gonna further enhance it and we'll turn it into an actual, get an actual course platform or host it somewhere. And then it'll become like an actual course. Then you register, you do quizzes, you get assessments. But as of right now, it's just a lot of material. And it's material that we really enjoyed making. So I really hope people check it out and tell us what they think. Because it was my journey through learning LLMs. Basically, I just went to these people at the company, and the other two authors, Jay and me, where I just went and asked them a lot of stuff, and we just played with it and put a bunch of labs and stuff. So it's really fun. I encourage people to take a look.
Yeah, I'll definitely take it. The only thing I took so far is the one from Andrew on prompt engineering.
Oh, well, great. Yeah. I want to take that one. That course did really well. I want to go check it out. Definitely. Yeah.
Cool. Without making the podcast too long, any last words from you, Luis, and then we'll wrap it up.
Oh, last words. Well, to you, thank you for the invitation. I'm so happy with, I've seen your progress and everything you've done and everything you do for the AI community and for the community in general. So thank you for that and definitely keep it up. And to the listeners, always stay hungry, stay learning. Things change so quickly that we have to always be learning. Also take care of yourselves, take care of your mental health. It's also very important. The world spins too quickly sometimes and sometimes things are overwhelming, but just take care of yourself. Don't try to learn all the things. Don't try to be on top of everything. Just make sure you're enjoying, and always keep an eye for the world that you dream about, right? The things that you want to do for the world, and always keep an eye on that and try to have that as your horizon.
That's motivating. And with that, thank you so much, Luis, and hope to see you soon in 3 years.
Yes, definitely. Thank you so much, Isaac.
Take care.